All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a very special show for you today. At the back end of the show, we're going to have a very special segment. It's been 10 years since the death of Oscar Brown Jr. Oscar was an extraordinary artist, and he was one of my closest friends. He's somebody I had an opportunity to work with a lot and learn from a lot. And so I thought, marking the anniversary of his death, I'd bring you an excerpt from a very special interview I did with him just about a year before he died. And before that, we'll be talking with Sandy McLeod. Sandy is the producer and director of a really great little film that I saw just last night, actually. And it's called Seeds of Time, which documents the work of Cary Fowler. And it's all about seeds and seed banks and why they're so damn important and what this one person, Cary Fowler, is actually setting out to do about it all right? And why it's so damn important for you to know about this. And opening the show up, I'm going to be talking with Scott Smith. Scott Smith is the chief scientist at Water Defense, and he's been described as a clean water warrior who has traveled across the United States and Canada to sites of toxic spills into our waterways in order to help mitigate environmental damage. And he has developed new ways to measure pollutants and to clean them up. And just recently, there's been a very significant oil pipeline leak just north of Santa Barbara. And Scott has been stationed up in Santa Barbara working on this oil pipeline leak. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Glad to be here.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this right away. The oil companies, you know, a friend of mine remarked recently that they all seem to be reading from the same script every time that there's a spill of any kind. Not much was spilled, didn't impact a very wide area, not many life forms are impacted. You actually were out there and saw what was going on. What's the real situation there, especially the area north of Santa Barbara where the spill occurred? What's going on there?
Yeah, it's north of what I call Ground Zero and south of Ground Zero. Well, I just got the initial water testing results that we did back about a half an hour ago, and it's more concerning after I've seen the results. Well, I can tell you on the ground, this is the thickest, tarriest oil that I have seen, and I've been on the ground and doing this since BP in over 50 disasters. And the impact on the beach is devastating. And I've been trying to, you know, fingerprint and figure out why that this is some of the thickest oil that I've seen, and I was there within 72 hours of the spill. We're detecting a lot of very dangerous chemicals of concern.
Like what? Can you give us an idea of what's there?
Yeah, not to get into too details. Like, there are levels of what we call metals and metalloids that are known endocrine disruptors in the water. There are concerning volatile organic compounds, what I call benzene-related, ethyl benzene, still hanging around. The issue is these chemicals and these metals that we're finding simply should not be in the beaches and in the water in Santa Barbara.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I read said that the fact that it occurred at the where the oil entered the ocean was actually where the ocean meets the land, and with the effect of the waves and everything else right at that spot, that it's actually more dangerous and worse than a regular oil spill. Is that true?
Yes, it is, because what the wave action has done, and you've got, you know, on the East Coast, we have eelgrass, you have kelp out there, and that oil and all the related toxic cancer-causing chemicals are hung up in the kelp right now. And the kelp is the food source for the food chain. So, and a lot of this oil, and I'm working with some private residents. I have to protect them because they're obviously very concerned, and they have had an inability to get proper technology in there to clean up the spill or let alone know what's in the water. So there, I continue to get calls and pictures from residents that are seeing oil still hit their beaches. Mm-hmm. You know, and what are we about? We're about a week out of the spill right now. So this is very, very far from over. And one thing to remember for you and the listeners is, you know, the EPA, according to the EPA, 1 gallon of oil contaminates 1 million gallons of water. So there you have it with your wave action and the way this is dissipating.
And just so people understand the significance of all this, you actually, you're talking about, when you said 1 gallon of oil equals this massive impact, we're talking about over 100,000 gallons of oil that came out in this now, right?
Correct. And that, I know that estimate, it was 21,000, and it's been moving up and down. And I think that's the latest I've seen. That the estimate is right around 100,000 gallons.
Yeah. And it's think about that. That's really massive. One of the things I was trying to figure out, too, they always talk about this is, and there's a tendency, there's a pull, and some of it is, you could say, okay, well, it's just habit. But a lot of times I think there's something more nefarious going on. This whole idea of this is a natural disaster, and it's the furthest thing from natural you can get, it would seem in my eyes, even looking at the fact that, you know, good Lord, they didn't even have an automatic shutoff valve on the thing.
Yeah, I know. And, again, that's a great point, Michael. You know, we talk about the best available technologies and instant communication. We have text messaging and everything. But there's something very strange when it comes to the best available technologies to protect our waterways. They're not being deployed, you know. And I want to point something out. You know, Kevin Costner's centrifuging technology, had it been in place and adequately prepared, you know, in the Gulf spill, there are a variety of technologies that were recommended, believe it or not, by the industry, by the American Petroleum Institute, by BP, and it fell on deaf ears of the elected officials throughout the country. And the shoreline impact, had there been proper preparations in place, and had BP and the API, now, you know, I tell it like it is. I'm not here to demonize anybody. I'm here to diagnose the problem so we can bring people together to solve it. But there were recommendations made for 5 years ago. Those weren't heeded. And had, like I said, had technologies like Kevin Costner's and a variety of, the, of others been prepared, the shoreline impact could have been prevented. So we are where we are now. And I got to tell you, it's my first visit to the Santa Barbara beaches. It's one of the most beautiful places I have ever been. And this is truly a tragedy.
Well, let's talk about this. What's the impact on the larger wildlife?
The sea lion, I understand there's an issue with sea lions right now, and we came across one dead sea lion. I know sea lions have been dying before this spill, but one of the specific sea lions that we saw wash up, it was near the Bacara Beach Resort, was floating and encapsulated in a pool of oil that came to the shore. So I don't know if they've done that. I know there were several other ones too. And, you know, the impact on the wildlife, we have yet to really see that. Look at the Gulf of Mexico and some of the other spills. You're not going to know the true impact on the wildlife and on the environment for maybe a year or two. That's why I'm so concerned about these chemicals that should not be in the ocean and on the beach that we've now detected. And this oil is so thick and tarry. The removal process is going to be very, very challenging. And the longer this oil continues to spread in that water and is on the beaches, the more dangerous it is to all life.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Scott Smith, who is the chief scientist at Water Defense, and he's been out at the Santa Barbara oil spill, and he's here to tell some truth about what's going on there, the impact of it and what's going on. Now, Scott, one of the things I also wanted to find out, and I have a series of questions that I just kind of sat down, and, you know, a friend of mine gathered some of them together, but then I also sort of sat down and looked at it and thought, okay, here's some definite things I want to raise to you. When you're just talking about this, the impact on the wildlife and the rest of this, what, you know, it's, I know that there's, you know, there's lots of, like, there's whales that and apparently, you know, the whales actually go past there quite a lot right now in this time of the year. And the impact on those kinds of, you know, beings or whatever they are, you know, these large mammals, you know, what happens there? You know, what is the danger there to things like whales? And then, could that also spread some of the things that they take in, they get infected by? Could that also spread up and down the coast?
Absolutely. This is unfortunately a tragic experiment now with a very sensitive ecosystem with a lot of rare species that is now, you know, spreading. I mean, all the water is connected, and it's very dangerous when people want to think that this is not isolated to Santa Barbara. Let there be no doubt about it. This is a problem for the entire coast of California.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and you know, with the whole food chain, I mean, what I learned out there about the kelp and the oil and the chemicals hung up in the kelp, and it's literally affecting everything that is alive in that ocean and near that ocean is being affected.
Wow. That is that's just mind-boggling. Well, let's talk about both the what you found in the chemicals there. What are the chemicals you found there, and what's the impact on the ecosystems, short and long term?
Well, short term, obviously, with some of these chemicals, people can get sick, nauseous, and dizzy. And in longer term, every human being is different, every life form is different. But there's not a lot of research out there at some of these like chromium compounds. There's a bunch of different metals and metalloids that are known endocrine disruptors and cause cancer. And And it affects every life form differently. And there's enough data out there that when you're exposed to that, you know, you may not get sick right away. You may get nauseous, but you may, you know, and you see some of these kids on the beach, you know, 8 to 12 years old, covered in this oil, and they don't know, and the families, and they may have no symptoms, and 5-7 years down the road, they may end up with some form of cancer. It's tough to answer because we just won't know the long-term effects for years.
Hmm. Boy. And did you find any chemical that you were actually surprised to find, or did you find anything that was actually, it would move you to like sort of stand up and start ringing
I'm
the bell real loud?
I'm really surprised, and I don't want to get too technical for the show, but you know, it's very detailed, the testing we get. I'm really surprised that 72 hours after the spill, the volatile organic chemicals and the ethyl benzene, trimethylbenzene, all these known cancer-causing things are still, you know, they haven't evaporated. So this is not going away. They are hanging around. And I'm very, very concerned about the workers I've seen on the beach. They don't have breathing gear on. And, you know, a lot of these workers are brought in from other places. And talking to them on the beach, I'm very concerned for them. I don't think they know what they're being exposed to. And you got to be kidding me. We live in a day with all our technology. So they're bringing in workers and giving them shovels and pails. In this today, I mean, to me, that's just simply unacceptable. What is going on here that we're not working to prevent these spills? I mean, spills are going to happen, but why don't we have things in place to prevent the shoreline impact? And then why are we putting people in harm's way with shovels and scrapers? It just doesn't make a lot of sense. And, you know, I know Governor Brown declared a state of emergency. So when you're out there on the ground, I don't think a lot of people know this. They're closing Refugio Beach and all those other places, but the Bacara Beach Resort and all those families, why isn't Governor Brown looking out for all those families and young kids that are now being exposed? We were right outside the Bacara Beach Resort, and we saw another wave of oil hit on Saturday, and all those chemicals are on the beach, and you know we have pictures and video of families and little kids getting caught in that oil. So they're, you know, the state asking people that can help to leave, and then where, you know, I'm concerned about the people that are being exposed right now on those beaches that don't understand what is going on, and I feel the state has an obligation to educate and warn them.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have one more question before we pursue what you just brought up, and that is, this whole coastal area north of Santa Barbara is often called the Galapagos of the North. Now, what kind of wildlife is there, and what's the impact on that ecosystem?
Well, that, you know, again, I'm not the wildlife expert in particular for out there, but I read this, you know, I've heard that same thing. And you don't want an oil spill anywhere, but this is one of the more sensitive ecosystems, and a lot of, endangered and precious species are there. So, mm-hmm. that, again, you know, all I know is the chemicals that we have found in the water and on the beaches are spreading. They shouldn't be there, and they pose a significant harm to that very sensitive ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's move into something else, because you've been, and this is related to this in some ways, but you've been part of another whole area of work in that area. And that's it's part of what you're doing now is actually part of a bigger picture, a larger picture of extreme oil extraction. Can you tell people what that is? And when people have looked at the Santa Barbara spill and thought, with all the problems cleaning this up in an accessible area during mild weather, you know, think about this, Scott. They're talking about, they just gave permission to Shell Oil to just charge into the Arctic and start drilling, you know, and you're looking at this, where this company, this whatever company it was, you know, whatever, you know, small company, you know, hired by, you know, whatever company is there, this company actually got away with having no shutoff valve, having total, it seems like total lack of preparation for some kind of an emergency like this. And what this sort of said to me was like, okay, it happened here, but now let's look. What are we going into in the Arctic, which is even more, you know, sensitive and under great danger and great threat right now?
Well, yeah, you bring up a great point, and we don't have enough time to discuss it, but I'll do my best to make what I be mm-hmm. to be very, very important points here. I think we failed as a society. I blame everyone in society, and I know I woke up 5 years ago in my own disaster, and shame on me for not waking up earlier. But society demands cheap oil, convenience, and You know, and with that, you know, these oil companies are giving the society what we demand, and society needs, all of us need to be more responsible about lowering our carbon footprint, using alternative clean energy, and a variety of things. And the real problem here is, there's no better way to say it, is the contamination within our elected officials and our regulation system. Unlike any other industry, in the FDA, and if you're a drug company introducing a drug, you have to have third-party testing to get that approved. The oil industry is in its own category, where there is heavy lobbying and ability to influence. So regulations do not get enforced. So who do you hold accountable in that situation? Well, I really hold accountable our elected officials, starting with the governor and the regulators, and why they're not enforcing the laws. They're not making certain that the communities are protected with the best available technologies when there is an event. And it is the question you asked is very, very complicated, and every single person in the United States bears the blame for this, because it's we as a society, we need to start holding our elected officials and our regulators accountable.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Scott Smith, who is the chief scientist at Water Defense, and he's been out at the Santa Barbara oil spill, and he's here to tell some truth about what's going on there, the impact of it and what's going on. Mm. Well, now, when you're thinking about that, I'm thinking about another area of work you're involved in as well, which is checking out the, you and the Water Defenders, you've been exploring the oil field water, the use of oil field water in California for crops. Let's talk about that in the time we have remaining, because it seems to be there's a little bit of a link here, this sort of all out, full into the wind, just like it's open season for the oil companies. And now that, there's this oil spill, and we also find out they're using or talking about using oil field water to irrigate crops. And especially in a time when there's a drought, people are sort of like, oh, oil field water makes sense. Sounds very dangerous to me.
It is very dangerous. And what you've got is 40-year-old regulations used to what I call, Beverly Hillbillies, Jed Clampett oil that comes out of the ground. Well, the regulations and the technologies used to monitor the water have not been updated for what I call the extreme energy extraction. And you've got fracking. You've also got cyclic steam stimulation, which in Kern County in the Coahuila Water District, that was the subject of, the LA Times article that we were involved in a few weeks ago, that's cyclic steam stimulation, and that for every gallon of oil uses 9 gallons of water. Now, given the drought and everything, so that oil wastewater goes through some kind of system, and we detected very concerning chemicals that should not be in irrigation water being used to irrigate, the almonds, the nuts, the fruits, the vegetables. So, when I was first asked to go out there, I actually was thought that, well, California, there's no way this kind of waste oil, contaminated wastewater could be used to irrigate the crops that we eat every day in the country. There's just no way. I had the perception that, California is the leader and the environment, and when I got out into those fields in Kern County, and I could smell the oil fumes that were worse than what I experienced on the ground for 4 months in the BP America, Deepwater Horizon incident. I couldn't believe it. So then we started testing and found that, where one water irrigation district runs into the other, what we call the confluence point, that there were, again, volatile chemicals of concern that should not be in the water, that if it were you or I, Michael, and we owned a business and those chemicals were in the water, we'd be shut down and we would be fined. And I don't think the general public really understands what's going on with the water and how we're losing this precious resource so rapidly. And we're now using, water with chemicals that should not be there, contaminants of concern that are being used to irrigate the, food we eat every day.
And what could be the possible result of all that?
Well, you know, that's a good question. And, you know, what the result I would like to see is we are want to be transparent and open. There are a lot of great people. And I just want to say we identify the problem with the intent of solving it. And we're very optimistic. I specifically am very optimistic with the technologies that are out there that we can die. You know, Albert Einstein said, you can't solve the problem until you diagnose it. And then when you solve the problem, you can't necessarily use the parties involved to be part of the solution. And Albert Einstein's really right. So we're going to diagnose the problem. We're bringing people together. And the next step is I would like to work with Chevron, with the regulators, and set new water testing standards everywhere, whether it's on beaches or in the irrigation water. And if we do this in a transparent way, which the community and the taxpayers and the voters in California deserve, they have a right to know what is going on with their water. So we should take all these different methods, have a round table, and continue to test the water. Because it's my understanding in Kern County that there's only 2 data points in the last 2 years. We took around 17 data points, and that's pretty scary to me that the industry itself and the regulators are relying on 2 data points to claim that the irrigation water is safe. And we have reached out. So if I am, you know, I've asked them to clarify that. I've asked them for more results. So we're hoping we're going to see more information. And I sincerely hope that there's more than 2 data points from the last 2 years. But so far I haven't seen any indication that there's more than 2 data points where the state is declaring the water safe.
You know, one of the things that's really very frightening and enraging is that when you're talking about all this and I keep thinking about, okay, during the Gulf oil spill recently, the one back a couple of years ago, you know, we were told all this time about, you know, and we could see the harm it was doing to these large fish and to the, you know, the tuna and all this other stuff. And then you could see what was happening to the shrimp, to the, you know, waterfowl, all this stuff. And now you're talking about these, this oil company water, this water that went through a whole process as part of the property of the oil companies, is now being used to irrigate the soil for our foods. And I keep thinking, am I going to start glowing at night because of this? You know, it's like, what is it doing to humans? I mean, this seems like just horrendous.
Yeah, and you know, and you look at, you know, we've been involved throughout the country in some cancer clusters where 11 people on a street are getting rare forms of cancer, and they all have one thing in common is bathing and being exposed to contaminated water. Mm-hmm. And some of this is from years of, you know, not even oil spill related. That's the scary thing, Michael, is a lot of this, these contamination sites are not, you know, oil disasters or spills per se. It's everyday contamination, and that's very concerning. There's no acceptable excuse for this going on in today's society with advances we are, that we are not monitoring our water and filtering it to protect everybody. It's just not acceptable.
Well, I agree on that, Scott. So thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay.
All right. Take care now.
Thanks.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Scott Smith, who's the chief scientist of the organization Water Defense, which was founded by Mark Ruffalo, and he's been described as a clean water warrior who has traveled across the United States and Canada to sites of toxic spills into our waterways in order to help mitigate environmental damage. And he's telling some truth about what's actually going on, what's the state of affairs up at the Santa Barbara oil spill. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back. Welcome back. That's a little bit more from my theme song, Let There Be Drums. Now we're going to move into our next guest. I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Sandy McLeod, who is the producer and director of a really cool film that I watched last night. It's called Seeds of Time, and it documents the work of a man named Cary Fowler, who is on a global mission to collect and preserve seeds representing the diversity of human food crops. And it'll just blow your mind when you see this film. Sandy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You have
great
to get
to
right,
be here.
Right.
Am
up
I
into
close
the mic.
Enough? Here we go. All
yeah,
right.
There you go. Okay. So let's jump into this.
how the hell did you come onto this? Because I was saying, when I first met you, I was saying, I've seen a lot of the films that you've made. I mean, even if, you know, you've worked with Jonathan Demme a lot. Stop Making Sense was actually a beautiful film that impacted my entire life, right? And you were there working on all that. Then you turn around and all the other films I've seen that you were working on, then you turn around and you're working on with this guy who says, hey, we got a big problem here. Seeds have to be saved. What brought you to the point where you wanted to make this film?
Well, I consider myself to be a foodie. I love to eat, and I think that I'm fairly well informed on some of the issues concerning food. But when I ran across an article that a friend of mine had sent me, actually David Byrne sent me, that was in The New Yorker called Sewing for the Apocalypse, I read about an issue, a pretty foundational issue in terms of food and food security that I knew absolutely nothing about. And as I was reading the article, I was at the breakfast table with my husband, and he was on the speakerphone talking to somebody. And I'm reading about this guy, Carrie Fowler, and I realize that my husband is talking to someone named Carrie, but I don't really think much about it. And then I get to a line in the article about funding for the vault and the collection of the seeds, and I hear my husband say, well, how much did you need to fund the collection of the seeds? And I hear Carrie Fowler say $30 million, and I read in the article $30 million were needed to collect the seeds, and I thought, wait a minute. So when that kind of synchronicity happens in your life, you know, you kind of got to pay attention. And when my husband hung up the phone, I said, was that Carrie Fowler? And he said, how do you know Carrie Fowler? So I was able to meet Carrie that summer, and Carrie is the guy, for those of you out there who don't know who we're talking about, who started the Seed Vault under the Arctic Circle, which has 800,000 varieties of different seeds and is the largest collection of seeds in the world. These are food seeds, crops. And the thing that I learned in that article that blew my mind was that in the last 80 years, from the last consensus that was done in the U.S. in 1983, from approximately 1907, we've lost a little over 90% of all the food seeds we once had. So we once had a great diversity in celery, for example. Lots of different kinds of flavors, lots of different kinds of tastes. Now we have three left. Ironically, I think I've only ever had one. I've only ever seen one in the supermarket anyway. So, you know, it behooves us as consumers to start asking for that diversity.
Well, you know when you're going to be in big trouble is when the only brand of lettuce that you see comes from, and it's called General Motors lettuce. Okay? Then we know something really bad is taking a leap. Okay?
That's right.
Let me ask you this, because we're talking about this, and for people to understand this, I do think they have to get a little bit deeper into what Carrie's all about, because he actually has looked at the world, and he looked at it and he thought, okay, there's a perfect storm brewing. And he began to wrestle with this idea of agriculture facing unprecedented challenges and threats, and that there's basically that we could use high-yield crops could actually die out because of a lack of diversity. And I wanted people to understand, he's actually talking about a very real problem we're facing of diversity, which people don't even think. Look, when I heard that and when I saw the film even, I was thinking, well, wait, what's, you know, do you really need 27 brands of, you know.
Well, and you go to the supermarket think, oh, there's plenty of diversity.
Right.
There's lots
Everybody's
of
growing lettuce. Come on, it all looks alike. But what is the importance of diversity, and what does it have to do with this sort of catastrophic situation he's predicting if we don't do something?
What diversity means is that there are lots of different traits in these vegetables. And when we started domesticating plants, we started selecting for the traits that we wanted. You know, we wanted this flavor or that flavor or this nutrient. And over time, we have bred these crops that are fairly rarefied. We've adapted them. And a lot of them aren't that nutritious anymore. A lot of them don't even have that much flavor anymore. And what's happened is we've bred out a lot of the traits that we're now going to need for the future. With all of the assaults that agriculture is now facing, limited arable land, huge population demands getting bigger, very scarce water supply, past peak oil for fertilizers. With all of that, now we're about to confront climate change. And most people think, well, you know, crops can just adapt. But they're very dependent on us for that adaptation. And how can they do that? We can't just move crops north. So we're going to need every bit of genetic diversity that we can find. And those are represented in all these different varieties of seeds that we don't grow anymore. We don't grow them because the farmer decided that, you know, that one wasn't the one he wanted to grow. Didn't have enough yield. It didn't, you know, do what he wanted it to do in the field. But those seeds are still there. And in those seeds, we might find the traits we need for drought tolerance or heat resistance or some of the things that we're going to have to really be, helping the plants with in the future.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sandy McLeod, the director of the film Seeds of Time.
Well, he actually makes the argument, too, that seeds are the most valuable resource on Earth, is what he says, you know, and it's very interesting because, you know, you wouldn't hear that everywhere today, you know. People are like, really, people are like, you know, well, I bought a pack of seeds, chia seeds. I'm going to grow chia. I don't know what the hell that is, but I used to have a dog named Chia. I really hoped they were going to grow them, but no, it didn't work that way. Anyway, but what Carey argues is that the fate of humanity is riding on this. To me, that's a huge statement to make, and he's got this, you know, and that's what gives him such drive to go and, you know, get offered this, go and talk to the people in Norway and get offered this thing that's like this vault that's at, like, you know, built into a frozen mountain, and he's, you know, just all these seeds there. And he actually says that seed diversity is the critical factor in the survival of the human race.
It's the foundation of agriculture, and we are civilizations rise and fall on their abilities to feed themselves. And this is going to become more and more challenging. So we need the basic foundational seeds to be able to adapt to what's coming.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sandy McLeod, the producer and director of the great film called Seeds of Time. And it's all about preserving seeds, preserving the diversity of seeds for the preservation of the human race, actually. Let's just be blunt about this. You know, one of the things that actually also got me is that, you know, this thing of he talks about climate change, not so much the individual farmer's desire to, like, you know, even if every farmer said, oh, I'm going to keep growing all these things, there's actually climate change has a major impact on the question of diversity. So in other words, it's not all the sort of subjective desire of a farmer to just do the easiest way out or the most profitable way out, but there's actually the impact of climate change, which brings it into a whole global perspective right away. The impact of climate change on seed diversity is terrible. And that's actually, so you have something that, you know, you have to fight with as well, you know, in terms of that, the overall change in the climate and what that's doing to crops.
Well, and we've developed as a global, as a planet, we've more and more gone towards monocropping. And this was the industrial farming was really what caused us to lose our diversity in the first place. Right now, for example, the world is 90% uniform in one variety of wheat. It was a very successful strain of wheat. Every farmer wanted to grow it and still does. It doesn't, what they call lodge, doesn't fall over, has a big seed head, very productive. So we're 90% uniform now in this variety of wheat. But there's a wheat rust, which is, you know, written about in the Bible, of these incredible plagues that came, called UG99, that started in Uganda in 1999, and it has started its way, jumped the Red Sea, went up through the Middle East, and is in Pakistan. And that wheat rust, when it lands on a crop, completely and totally destroys it almost overnight. And we have no known defense for that wheat rust. And because we're so uniform in wheat, and this is something we'll probably see more and more of, when you're growing everything in the field, acres for acres and acres and acres and acres, is the same variety, what kills one kills them all. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't have diversity in the field, and every subsistence farmer knows this, and subsistence farmers are actually the people who have helped preserve some of this diversity that we talk about. if you don't have diversity, you're going to lose everything.
Mm-hmm. There's a thing here, too, because everything you're saying, again, it comes down to, you know, it's interesting. I don't know if you heard that my first guest, but Scott was talking about a whole section of, you know, the way that these oil spills happen and what's happening with the human environment and how it's really tied into the drive for more profit that the capitalist system actually brings out. I mean, he didn't say capitalism, but I'm saying capitalism because it's clearly the system. It's not just these companies operating on their own. But then you look at the, you know, they're killing us from every conceivable angle, pushing things to disaster from every conceivable angle. Who's responsible by and large for the intensifying of global warming and that climate change? And then the production for profit. Yes, all this stuff, the seeds that they decide to propagate and then to push on. And then what happens with all the seeds that maybe would have been able to handle global warming or would have been able to handle being watered by oil water, then those things disappear. And that's when you think about that, what that brings into mind is actually this whole point that Kerry is making a lot about this human catastrophe, the possibility of the end of the human race tied in very, very, very carefully and very, a million overwrappings with the future of agriculture, the future of seeds. So I wanted to ask you about that, but also then the seed bank, so people can know about the seed bank, because we only have about 4 minutes left.
Well, so seed banks have been around ever since agriculture started, but there are probably about 1,200 of them all over the world. The one in Svalbard backs up those seed vaults. It's like a safety deposit box. They put their seeds in. They're the only people that can.
This is Kerry's seed bank.
This is Kerry's seed vault that's under the Arctic Circle, that is climate controlled and pretty bulletproof as you can be in a world where who knows what can happen next. But there's a lot of diversity in seed banks too, and seed banks unfortunately also go extinct. Most of them, some of the best collections are in the developing world, and they're one power outage away from an extinction. Even in the United States, a very wealthy country with a pretty darn good seed bank in Fort Collins, Colorado, we cut the annual budget there by 10% last year, which is a lot for people who are trying to perpetuate a bank and grow out those seeds and keep them healthy. So even here, we have trouble funding that very sort of fundamental part of agriculture. Mm-hmm. And seed banks get taken out, and we lost the one in Afghanistan that had very rare varieties of apricots and almonds, and so it affects us all the way down to our plates, mm-hmm. And what Kerry's done by preserving these seeds is, one of the reasons I wanted to make this film is I think that he, as an individual, has probably done more for every single person on the planet than just about anyone I can think of, because it does reflect itself on your plate.
And even raising this question in today's atmosphere is extremely important. I was thinking about I used to do a lot of writing about Ethiopia during the famine in the 80s. And one of the things I found was that there used to be this very hardy strain of wheat that was grown in Ethiopia that was capable of withstanding a lot of the kind of famine conditions that there, the desertification, all this stuff. And apparently the people in Ethiopia no longer have those seeds because the U.S. took the seeds and put them in a bank in Rome. And they held on to them. And they decided they would sort of cross them with another very hardy seed, wheat seed, and they created a seed that could actually withstand any of the climate conditions that were going on in Ethiopia and the Horn of Africa, where, keep in mind, millions of people were dying, because they couldn't eat, and they had to make horrendous decisions about who to save in their family because they couldn't, there was no food. And this seed bank in Rome held on to those seeds, and they were not allowed to sell them to the Ethiopians, even though they had taken one of the original, components of their new seed was Ethiopian wheat. And they just held it and used it as a political tool to pressure the Ethiopians to break from the Soviet imperialists when the Soviets were actually controlling Ethiopia at the time. So you're looking at all that and you're thinking, if we ever needed someone, and I have to say this, Carrie, from what I've seen, I don't know him, but from what I've seen, he just seems like a really good-hearted, smart cat who actually is saying, we've got to do this. And he did the investigation, the study. He knows what's going on. And his desire to actually stand up and fight for humanity and its future and human society. And I was really impressed with it. So I'm just going to say, in closing, it's a great film. I got to thank you very much, Sandy, for coming in today. Right, I really appreciate it.
Thank
and
you.
Thanks for another great film. I really liked it a lot. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back. Welcome back. As I told you at the beginning of the show, this is a very special segment of the show dedicated to Oscar Brown Jr. It's been 10 years since Oscar Brown Jr. died, and he was 78 when he died, and he had lived a rich, full life centered around his art, his commitment to fighting the oppression of black people, and a ceaseless quest for a just world. And he managed to do all that with an ever-sharpening wit and a warm and deep humor. Oscar was a very, very dear friend of mine, someone I learned a lot from, and someone who I miss every day. And I want to share a little bit of an interview I did with him just about a year before he died. And this is only a segment of this very special interview. If you want to access the rest of it, you can go to soundcloud.com/Michael-Slate, and you'll be able to access the interview there. So without any further ado, let's just jump right into it. Oscar Brown Jr. Well, that's all of this. Did you suffer a lot in terms of this repression, in terms of actually open repression that you know of?
Suffer is not exactly the word that I would. I've encountered it and been, you know, beat down a couple of times by a whole bunch of stuff. When I started out, I was doing like Brown Baby. Now, Brown Baby is a lullaby. That was considered controversial. You didn't have to be saying off the pig. What they really, really didn't want you to say was something that was going to create sympathy, empathy, that was going to create a humanistic feeling between people. That was more dangerous by the standards of the people who were running the broadcast industry at that time. And at this time, even worse, that was what was considered controversial. The most subversive things I've done has been to work with kids in the projects and try to work with a gang in the streets and try and get them to have a revolutionary attitude about themselves, about their plight, to have them stop fighting each other like the Crips and the Bloods did, the Hispanic gangs. You guys are being divided and conquered, and you don't see that. And as they began to see it, it turned out that the police didn't want the gang to go good. So 30 years later, I wrote a song. It was a gang gone good in a real bad hood. Police never believed they would. Got to be busted, not to be trusted, they say they. And that was the attitude, was to stop this, to not let this out.
Let's talk about this a little bit, because you've written, in addition to this, you've written operas. And interesting enough, in iambic pentameter too, right?
Yeah.
And you've written theater, a lot of
that plays. Was a collaboration with Lonnie Levister. His music, I did the lyric.
What was that?
A Slave Story, the one you're talking mm-hmm. about. It started out being called Slave Story, and it's gone through several evolutions of name. Mm-hmm. Latest being Creasy. That's the heroine's name.
I wanted you to actually talk a little bit about those operas and what made you decide to work in a form like opera.
Well, I heard Puccini. Actually, I was listening to the radio, and hey, shoot, hang on, I'd like to get off into something like that. But I didn't have the musicianship to write an opera. But I told that to Lonnie Levister, who was a classically trained musician, a very gifted man. He was in New York at the time, and we started working on it, and we got quite a way along with it. In fact, we finished it. It took several years to do. But it was done, as you said, in iambic pentameter, rhymed quatrains. Interesting story. The first time I undertook that, we had had the idea and we'd been working on the songs, but now I decided I was going to try and put this in iambic pentameter. So it would take me all day long, 12 hours to do one page. And I was just not even coming out of the room, except they'd send in my meals. You know, I had to go to the restroom a couple of times, but otherwise, man, I was in that. And I did it 7 days a week for a whole month, 30 straight days of 12-hour days working on this thing. And I finally had the first scenes together. And I was going to the Democratic Convention. I was asked to entertain at this Democratic Convention when the year when Goldwater was running. And on my way to Atlantic City, I passed through Philadelphia and lost the script, both copies of the script, in the airport. Man, when I got to Atlantic City and realized that, I just lay on the bed and tried to die. But then as I was dying, I realized that I remembered every page. It had taken me so long, it was so hard to do, that I had a third carbon copy in my head. And with that, I was relieved that I hadn't really lost it because I still had it. And when I got back to Philadelphia in the train station, I guess it was, anyway, this red cab had found my script. So I got it back.
You've worked in opera, you worked in theater. And there's two plays in particular I wanted to talk, well, three actually, briefly on Mr. Kicks and sort of there's an interesting part about that, including how you're probably the first artist who's ever had a law specifically enacted because of what they did to get their play produced. And then I wanted to also move into, from there, a brief thing on Opportunity Knocks and then on Buck White.
Well, you know, life has sort of caught me by surprise. And so it certainly did this offer from Dave Garraway to come on to the Today Show to promote Kicks and Company. That was a kind of a promotional stunt. Nobody would have thought.
And Kicks and Company
It was a musical on which I had been working for a couple of years. It grew out of a friend told me that in this sort of dormitory dwelling where he was living, that the main thing was kicks. Everybody was just looking for kicks. So I went out on a New Year's Eve party, and that next morning, tore up. I came home and I started writing this. I met this character, Mr. Kicks, and he evolved into a musical that eventually wound up raising $400,000, passing through the Today Show, where Dave Garraway offered us the whole 2 hours to raise money for this production. And it wound up standing up in Chicago and dropping all $400,000 in about a week, after which I had just started. Now I was a has-been. I hadn't even been in the business but 9 months, and I had to have a comeback.
Well, one of the things helping your comeback was they actually did pass a law saying that you were no longer...
Well, that no more could they raise money that way by offering stock in a production on the air. Woody King Jr., who was a successful producer in New York at the Federal Theater, he told me about this law. He said that all the young producers in New York, when they saw that, they said, holy smoke, now this is not my doing. I'm just the writer. The way it came about was I had been performing at the Village Vanguard, my first engagement in show business. And while we were doing that, we were also raising money for this first musical, Kicks and Company. And the agents, I was quite well received. And the agents were trying to show me what they could do because they wanted to sign me up. And Joe Glazer, I think, was one of the big agents, ABC agency. He got me on the Today Show, and I did Brown Baby and Rags of the Line and That Dare. Dave Garraway was so impressed, he brought his daughter to the Vanguard to see my act. And when I did songs from Kicks and Company, he offered to turn over the whole 2 hours to, I think it might have got him fired because that was going a little far. Mm-hmm. As I was working with the writers, I remember a guy named Rick Ballard was one of the writers. And Rick asked me, he said, did Dave read this play? I said, no. He said, I didn't think so. Because the play was saying, you know, we don't want to get integrated into a burning house. Raisin in the Sun had been quite successful just prior to that. In fact, it was Lorraine Hansberry's husband who was the producer of Kicks and Company. But Raisin was like, you know, wanting integration. It was talking about upward social mobility, moving into the suburbs as an achievement. And Kicks and Company was saying, we don't want to be, you know, a part of the same old pie. And so it was a little more revolutionary than America was.
Well, let's move into that, off of that, move into Buck White. And there were some pretty significant things about Buck White, including some of the songs that were in it.
Well, thank you, Michael. Mm-hmm. That's nice of you to say that. Buck White started out as a straight play. It was a writer's workshop piece in Watts. Following the Watts riots, Bud Schulberg from here in Hollywood started a writer's workshop. And a man named Joseph Dolan Tuwadi came to that workshop with a little sketch that he had done that revolved around a character called Big Time Buck White. And the actors with whom he was working began to improvise, pretty much drawing the characters out of themselves. So there was the Hunter and Jive and Weasel, and these cats who were playing the parts were pretty much that in life. And they put the show on. They got a producer, Zev Buffman, and they put the show on at the Coronet Theater here in Los Angeles. And I saw it. I just fell out laughing. These were some characters, boy, I had known all my life. And as a result, I went home and started doing little character revealing songs about some of these characters in that. And again, you know, most of the things that happen, you think there's some fortuitous event. Somebody was going to produce Big Time Buck White in San Francisco, called Bill Cosby to see if he would be interested in it. I had a friend in Bill Cosby's office who knew Bill Cosby wasn't going to be interested in it, but knew that I would. And so I wound up flying to San Francisco and talking them into, instead of doing the straight play, to doing this musical that I had developed. And that ran there in the area for about 6 or 8 months. After which I went down and talked to Zev Buffman, who had the grand rights. I only had the rights in the San Francisco Bay Area. So he said, well, he would give me the grand rights, but he wanted to write a first refusal to produce in Hollywood or on Broadway. Broadway. Oh, so now what do we need to go on Broadway? I thought you'd never mention it. So he said, you know, star. And at that time, my uncle passed away in Chicago, and I flew back to his funeral, and I knew Ali. So I went over to Ali's house. He wasn't allowed to fight. He was just living in a little bungalow with the World Heavyweight Championship belt in there. So he wasn't making that much money and everything, so I was able to make him an offer he couldn't refuse. He was dynamite, I thought. And the whole experience was great for me. We played the show with Ted Ross and Big Black as the title characters in San Francisco. But now in New York, we had Ali. I was able to try out some of my ideas and do stuff on Broadway. And, you know, I found out I belonged there. I mean, I was not over my head at all. And the people with whom I was working, who were all professionals, were quite complimentary and cooperative. So that gave me a great deal of satisfaction and sense of accomplishment.
I want to remind people that we're talking with Oscar Brown Jr. But one of the things that always tripped me out was the song that you had Ali singing. The song that you wrote for Ali, this is a time when they had taken his belt away and he was being vilified in the press. The Vietnam War is raging. Black people all over the country are rising up in ghettos and saying, we're not going to live like this anymore. And you had Ali come down the stage. And I remember you describing it to me once. You had kettle drums banging, you had fireworks going off, and you had Ali come on the stage and sing, "It's All Over Now, Mighty Whitey." What was the story behind that?
Madness.
Needless to say, the critics weren't real happy.
Well, they had been pretty happy in San Francisco. We had run the show, as I said, there for quite a little while, and now we transferred to New York. And, yeah, Buck White, he doesn't make his entrance until the end of the first act, and he would enter through the audience. And I was able to get them to put lights up in the ceiling way up high there and have fireworks going, boom, and the thing would light up, and then the timpani was playing. And on one night, the first time we actually ran the show, it was a Monday night, and we invited all the gypsies, all the actors from all the shows that were dark on Monday, free of charge, because we wanted Ali to have a chance to have an audience, a live audience, before we opened. So this was news. The television station had cameras there, and the guy was backing down the aisle in front of Ali with his camera, and behind him was a power pack of lights, you know. So I added that to the show, too. I could do whatever I wanted, you know, make it exciting. And it was really a marvelous, you know, moment in the theater to me when Buck White came in. And then people would look, and this was actually Muhammad Ali doing this.
And there was so much combined to that. If you could just tell people what the song was about.
Oh,
and where the title came from.
It came from, it was originally titled Word from Watts. It came out of the Watts riot. And a reporter from Time magazine had been there and told me he'd been in this supermarket. And the brothers had come in there and started stealing stuff. And he said, Mighty Whitey didn't do a damn thing. So I started writing this song. We see you looking cruel with your cold blue eyes. You think we're just your fools. You think you're all wise. We see you wallowing in your greed while we are down here in dire need. But that's all over now, Mighty Whitey. All over now. Ali loved that song.
I can imagine.
And that's how I got him to, you know, want to do that in the first place.
I can imagine the impact of that song had actually been out broadly in society, that would have had a tremendous impact.
Yeah, well, of course it would have. And so that's why it closed exactly after 6 days.
Right. They made a quick decision on that one.
Oh, no brainer.
One thing we got about a minute to talk about, is it Opportunity Knocks?
Yeah.
One of the things that you said there was that the most important thing you learned out of that was that actually the people, the basic people in Black neighborhoods had the skills, the talent, the ability to come forward and produce tremendously beautiful things. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the Black Bottom, that's where it is. I just was riding through that neighborhood sort of dreaming that they should have some kind of a self-help organization because the neighborhood had turned black, but these kids were, it was going down. So I got an opportunity to work with these young people. And I was offering to do a show for them to help them raise money and stop extorting and doing some of the illegal stuff they were doing. So they said, well, look, some of us got talent. Can we be in the show? So I said, well, God, let me see what you got. And they had so much that the idea of doing a show for them was replaced by doing a show with them. And that was called Opportunity Please Knock. And it was just a whole group of kids who were marvelous. We had found a great number of kids, and like 2 years ago, we brought back some of them and put together a show, Opportunity Knocks Again, with 30 of them. And hearing them sing those old songs, those old doo-wop songs now with whole choir, wow, that was really exciting. Somebody's going to do that. You know, we couldn't. Again, the city won't take yes for an answer.
Real quick, you continue to work these Shakespearean sonnets that I wish we had actually gotten a chance to talk a little bit more about, but we'll have to have you back to do that. Also, you've been on the Deaf Poetry Jam, again, impacting a whole new generation of artists, of rebellious youth, of people just looking to use their art in the service of the people. And you performed a poem there that just blew me away, and it blew the audience away. I wanted to go out with that poem. Oscar, how about it?
I apologize for being black, for all I am plus all I lack. Please, sir, please, ma'am, give me some slack, because I apologize. I apologize for being poor, for being sick and tired and so. Since I ain't slick and don't know the score, I must apologize. I apologize because I bear resemblances black people share. Thick lips, flat nose, and nappy hair. Yes, I apologize. I apologize for how I look, for all the lows and blows I took on those. Lord knows I'd close the book as I apologize. I apologize for all I gave, for letting you make me your slave and going to my early grave. I do apologize. I apologize and curse my kind for being fooled, for being blind, for being ruled and in a bind. I must apologize. I apologize and curse my fate for being slow, for being late, because I know it's me you hate. Why not apologize? I apologize and tip my hat, because you so rich and free and fat, son of a bitch, that's where it's at. And I apologize.
All right, that was the interview I promised you at the beginning of the show, a very special interview with Oscar Brown Jr. just about a year before he died. And again, if you want to access the whole interview, which I would really recommend people do, you can go to soundcloud.com/Michael-Slate. All right, and that'll get you the entire interview. All right, I want to thank all of my guests today, and I want to thank everyone who's involved in the production of this show. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com, and we're going to go out with one more song from Oscar Brown Jr., 40 Acres and a Mule.
If I'm not mistaken, I once read back during that short spell I spent in school where every slave set free was supposed to get for slaving 40 acres and a mule. Now, you know, telling how much work was done by my ancestors under slavery's rule, but sure as hell the total's got to run at least 40 acres and a mule. Now, I'm not saying this to see folks sweat, 'cause I'm not bitter, neither am I cruel, but ain't nobody paid for slavery yet about my 40 acres and my mule. We had a promise that was taken back.